welcome to another installment of Innovation Crush. It is I, Chris Denson, the Densonologist, here with the queen of ologies, Ellie Ward. Say hello.
Hi.
How are you? Very excited
to be here.
Are you?
That didn't sound excited. I was trying. I came in so hot with that high that I was like, tone it down, Ellie. And then
you're calibrated.
Yeah. Then I had to be like, excited to be here. Because I came in like I was talking to a puppy. So I was like, all right, chill out.
I don't know if I take offense to that or not.
I was just very, very
So for the folks who may not know, what is an Ellie Ward?
An Ellie Ward is an elective redhead. This is not natural. And I'm a correspondent on CBS's show, The Henry Ford's Innovation Nation with Mo Rocca. It's a very long title and a good program.
No acronym. You know,
no.
The HF.
You know, we call it HFIN sometimes in shorthand, but you know, you do you.
HFIN is good.
But
it's different than HNIC, which...
Good point.
That's a whole other thing.
I don't know what that is. I'm going to be honest with you.
It's the term we use in the community for the person who's in charge.
Okay. Got it. No, just Henry Ford's Innovation Nation with Mo Rocca.
There you go.
Title. So I'm a correspondent on that, and I write a segment called Vocabulary, which I discuss terms and their meanings. And then I also have a podcast called Ologies. It's a different ologist every episode, which means we have to get a Densonologist on.
there's only one.
I know. It's just very thrilling. you're both researcher and subject.
Right.
Of the same ology.
That's how I roll.
I know, which would be so exciting.
Study and experiment on myself.
Do you have any objectivity as a researcher in Densonology?
That was a little too science-y of a sentence for me, but yes. How about that?
Yeah, that's a good answer.
There's an answer. That's quite the resume. But let's get into the Innovation Nation portion of it. I'm just going to abbreviate it to Innovation
Nation. Yeah, that's what we do. That's our shorthand.
So how did that come to be for you? Because, I mean, we've known each other for a while, and I've known a lot of different iterations of Ellie Ward, all redheaded, though.
Yep.
But how did Innovation Nation come to life for you in your career?
Well, I'd always loved science and in media. So I had studied biology and TV and film in college. And I always wanted to do something with the two of them. And I wound up as a writer for the LA Times. And I wanted to get back into broadcast. I ended up getting into broadcast because this video I did went viral. It was disgusting. It was a cocktail made out of a milkshake and chicken nuggets. We don't have to talk about it. But anyway, I ended up working for Cooking Channel with a friend.
Is that what it takes to get a job on the Cooking Channel? You have to make a disgusting cocktail?
Literally, evidently. Because in subsequent seasons, they were like, hey, can you blend a piece of pie in the blender? And I was like, I mean, the answer is yes.
The answer is always yes.
Can I is a yes. Should I is a no. But so I did that for a while. But my heart was always in science, and I kind of did food TV. It was fun, and it was goofy, and it was interesting, and I traveled around for it and stuff. But I always really wanted to do science stuff. Like, you know, I love innovation, and I love science stuff. So I started volunteering at the Natural History Museum. Have you been to it in LA downtown?
Yes, I have. Yeah.
Do you have a favorite wing there?
Anything? I haven't been there enough to have a favorite wing, but I went for like an insect exhibit.
Yes, probably did.
It was last year. And that was crazy. Like the people that go crazy over bugs.
Yeah.
Like, you know, I enter those kind of communities. I'm like, I'm an observer and a participant. Like, I'm I'm an unwilling participant. But especially when you have kids, you're like, all right, yeah, let me show up.
Yeah.
But to see people like that are nuts over just... what we may consider minutia is pretty intense.
I know. I'm one of those people. I love bugs.
My favorite wing is the bug wings.
The bug wings. I love the bug exhibit there. I love that place. I started volunteering there because I had a really sad summer. I had like a really bad breakup. My dad got sick. Just all this stuff went wrong. And someone suggested that I volunteer there. And I was like, wow, I don't even know how to volunteer at a museum. Anyway, I went through orientation and I was like, sure, man, why not? So I worked there like Wednesday mornings, 3 hours a week for $0. Like, in between like shooting segments for Cooking Channel and stuff. And I have a friend who works on science shows and recommended me as a host. It's like, yeah, she's, you know, she was a science major, a film major, and she's, you know, she's down at the museum sometimes. And anyway, I met with the Innovation Nation people and they were so great. And they had, you know, they were just working on season one of this show. They hadn't launched it yet. And I told them how excited I was about science. And I'd done a lot of TV, but this would be like my first real spot as a correspondent. And I love this show. I've gotten to do it for, I think we're starting season five now.
Wow.
Our 100th episode is coming out later on this month, I think on the two Saturdays from now.
Well, so. Congratulations.
Yeah.
So that's pretty awesome.
So we troll around town and we just interview innovators.
So, yeah. So walk us through like, and I mean, I've seen it in CBS Saturday mornings. Yes. But like, just walk us through an episode of what gets covered. Cause it's one thing I really admire about the show is that it's really fun and digestible, right? It's not like over the top, hit you in the head with scientific facts. And there's a lot of shows out there that do it, but just kind of walk us through like the storytelling in one particular episode.
Yeah. It's put on by the Henry Ford, which is a museum in Dearborn outside of Detroit. And, my sister lived in Detroit for like 10 years. So I already love Detroit. So
did we have a Detroit conversation before?
You're from Michigan?
Yeah, that's my hometown. I'm from Detroit.
What part of Detroit?
7 Mile Grand River.
Oh, my goodness.
Yep. I went to Southfield Lathrop, went to Michigan State. Shout out to my Chargers and my Spartans.
I love Detroit.
Not that this episode is about me.
No, I continue. I get to talk about Detroit all day. I love it.
No, that's awesome.
But so Dearborn is just outside of it. So I was familiar with the museum. I was familiar with the area. So so it's put on by the museum. And so Mo Rocca is from The Daily Show's like... He's great. He's the main host. And so they shoot a segment for every episode in the museum, usually about something in their collections, whether it's like the Dymaxion house, this crazy old weird house that was built in the 50s that looks like Jiffy Pop. It's like round and silver and was like the house of the future to like, you know, the Wright brothers planes to all these. They have so many cool exhibits. So they talk to a curator. They do a segment there. And then there are a few of us correspondents that they send out. Albert Lawrence is one and Adam Yamaguchi is another. And we are kind of field correspondents. So we go all over the country and sometimes we've been all over the world now, like England and Sweden and stuff, and talk to inventors and ask them, like, what's the deal here? How did you invent
this? What's wrong with you?
Yeah. How does your brain work?
Yeah.
Like, and I've not invented anything.
Yeah, I'm sure you've invented. You invented a chicken McNuggetini.
That's the scope of my invention.
You took some other people's stuff and put it together.
Exactly.
That's kind of invention.
It's a hack.
Yeah. There you go.
A shake hack. but yeah, so I've interviewed like people who've invented, like Marty Cooper invented the cell phone to this, you know, the amazing inventors. Like the first segment I ever did was this woman who was 18 years old, got a $100,000 scholarship to MIT for working on biofuel in algae. So it's just all of these different amazing inventors who have done these great things. And we talk about like their failures along the way and how they got up and kept inventing and what advice they give to future innovators. So it's really cool. It's also very like, you walk away like with a little self-help nugget. I usually do. I'm like,
did you use the word nugget on purpose?
I did not.
this is all we're going to talk about this whole time.
I was too chicken.
No, that's what I was going to ask you. Like, hey, what's in it for the audience? Yes, of course. Please answer that. But also, what's in it for you? You know, I think sometimes as a host, like you're going around, you're like educating yourself for an audience. So there's like a double layer there. What's that experience like from what's in it for the audience and what's in it for you?
Yeah, I guess you probably know that too, because you interview interesting minds and inventors. But if you're not actually interested, your questions are going to come off probably a little tepid. Like, so why this? You know,
what's that over there?
Yeah. And so I think for me, I'm really interested in the jump it takes from idea to from conception to execution. That leap is huge. Because like, how many notebooks do you have full of ideas for books or podcasts or talks or, you know, robot arms or whatever that,
or reams of paper.
Reams of paper. I did purchase at Staples across the street right before this a bunch of paper that I use in my idea books. But I think that there's such a leap between like making something a reality. And that to me is what's really interesting. Is like, it's great to have an idea, but like, how do you go through the obstacle course to execute it? Because it's like, someone's going to be like, that idea sucks. And you're going to be like, oh, maybe they're right. You know? Or your first mold is going to melt, or you're going to try it 1,000 times. It's not going to work, or you're going to run out of funding, or someone else is going to come up with something that hits the market right before yours. And maybe it's not as good. So you got to keep going. So I think it's always interesting. I think that's the takeaway so much, is not only like keep innovating, but like the show's whole motto is dream big and don't quit. Because that's like what we hear from so many innovators. It's like, yeah, like try to think of something that the world needs, and, you know, sky's the limit, and just keep at it.
Yeah. Even in that journey, like how much do you guys cover the in-between, right? The in-between, yeah. Because what it is always fascinating,
yeah,
you know, in most cases, because from a curation standpoint. But then, yes, and I find, at least with this show, it's like, There's some similarities about personalities, but there's also just who that individual is as a weirdo. They're all in their own zone, present company included. Uh-huh. But you know, what have you seen? Maybe some stories or just some examples of things you've seen in between those two points.
Oh man, you know, one innovator, this one comes out this coming Saturday. Lonnie Johnson, he's in Atlanta, and he's like rocket scientists, like nuclear physicists. I can't even recall his whole resume, but he's this really incredible engineer who worked on like the Galileo spacecraft for NASA. And he is right now, he's working on some solar arrays and also some better battery technology. So he's a hardcore engineer. He started in robotics in high school, but the thing that he made millions on was the Super Soaker, which was the squirt gun that can just douse you.
Yes.
And he has so many patents. Like, his office is just, it's like wallpapered with these plaques of patents. He's constantly thinking, constantly iterating. And that was one idea. He just was like, his daughter was like in a water gun fight, and he's like, yeah, we could do this better. And so he starts coming up with this like a hydraulic pump, and he's like, okay. So he fashions it out of PVC pipe, and first time he tried it, he was filled it up in the bathroom, and he just did a pump, and he saw the force that it squirted with, and he was like, oh man, I'm onto something here. And so he went into a toy company, and he said that he was in a meeting, and he's like, you guys want to see this thing? And they're like, yeah, he squirt it. And so he does it across the boardroom, and he just like sold it that day. Everyone's like, what? And we're so used to it now. But, you know, that's not his most technological invention.
Sure.
But that was something that just took off in such an insane way. And he uses the revenue from that to fund all kinds of programs for engineering outreach, and to fund, you know, more, you might say, like complicated technologies. So,
right.
So his story is so fascinating, because you're like, here's this NASA engineer who's like, made a crazy water gun, man.
Well, I mean, you know, I think it does take that eye for playfulness for a lot of innovators, I'll say, you know, and not being so rigid in this is my science, this is my craft, spotting an opportunity. And yeah, like I've had probably a dozen ideas about like how to make a water gun better. What if we, but I don't do it.
Yeah.
Right. I think that's so. And I like, speaking of the playfulness, I like the fact that the show does have this tint of humor. Like, I mean, Mo's pretty weird and silly. Yeah, like, you're hilarious. How important is it? Is that lightheartedness to the process of creating the show?
You know, I think that I was lucky that I was one of the first correspondents that they hired, and so this is so terrible, but I have also done some comedy stuff, like Key and Peele, and I did Drunk History, so I've done some Comedy Central stuff, and like, you know, live comedy things. And so I was really worried, because they had me on, they wanted me on, and I was like, okay, at some point they're going to find out that I did Drunk History and they're going to fire me. I was like, I waited till the contracts were signed. I was like, I had my paperwork, and I was like, do you guys know that I did this thing? And they're like, oh yeah, no, we saw it right away before we even interviewed. We thought it was hilarious. And I was like, okay, so I can be myself, kind of. And granted, it's like, you know, it's an all ages show. So I, you know, I have to keep it clean, but it was really great to know that they were definitely up for, you know, like Mo's background was a Daily Show and stuff. So they were up for kind of dry humor, weird humor. And I don't know, I think it's kind of important, because so there's this big gulf in science between like, you're a scientist, so that means you're serious and smart. I'm not a scientist, that means I'm weird and goofy. But I think that like getting that out of the scientists and innovators,
right,
getting those little human moments of like, you know, of either failure or success or humility is like really helps the audience connect.
Yeah, no, the human, I tell people all the time, like this, these conversations are very much human interest stories.
Yes.
Right? Because these are life lessons, you know, the fact that, you know, Lonnie is it, mm-hmm. was able to just capture that opportunity and use it to do what he really wants. It. Like all of us are in some form of that situation where you're like, you're doing something and you actually have your eye on another prize. Mm-hmm. Right. And sometimes the means to an end isn't always a linear, you know, path.
Totally. And it's interesting too, because then there are a lot of innovators we talk to who have other jobs while they're tinkering on something they're super passionate about. Easton LaChapelle is someone that I just interviewed for the season in Colorado. He's 22 years old, but at 14, he invented a robotic arm. He was kind of tinkering he made it out of like Lego blocks and fishing wire. And he ended up kind of stumbling upon something that could be really useful for amputees. And so he now is able to make those prosthetic arms cost like $80,000, mm-hmm. but he's able to do it for like $5,000 and it works better and it's more lifelike. And he is so passionate about it. Like it is what he lives and breathes, you know? So it's really cool to see. I'm not going to go out and make an amazing robotic arm.
Yeah.
This guy is really into it. He's the dude for the job. He's working tirelessly. So it's interesting too, to see how diverse people's passions are, you know? And that's been really cool.
You said something a second ago around just like the different personality expectations, mm-hmm. right? Like you're the comedy person. Oh, hopefully they didn't see the Drunk History episode. Yeah. And I'm sure that, like there's a slight amount of real fear there, you know? or even when we were talking before, you're like, I don't know if I can be my full comedy self.
Right. Because we won't be dropping a lot of F-bombs.
Yeah. You have the fiery red hair adds to the fiery humor. But, you know, did it take, maybe this is just for me, but did it, what was your process or what went into you embracing all of who you are? You know, science, comedy, nerd, host, you know what I mean? Like all these different things and being comfortable to walk in that.
Oh, that's such a good question. I think it's so hard too for people who are performers and also journalists and writers. When you wear a lot of hats and you're like, I don't know which aspect of me is the one that, I mean, because at the end of the day too, you've got to pay rent, you've got to pay a mortgage, you've got car insurance. Like, so this is also a job for us. So it's hard when you have kind of diverse interests to be like, well, which one should I bank on? You know, like, am I going to follow this thing and it's going to end up, I'm going to live under a bridge. So I think it was tough for me because I was like, for a long time when I was doing a lot of food stuff and Cooking Channel, I was afraid to post pictures of like bugs I found or the museum on my Instagram because it was like, well, people are going to be like, what? I follow you for like tips on how to make margaritas and like how to have a party, how to make a surprise party for my friends. And so I kind of started gradually doing that. And I started seeing feedback from people being like, oh, that's so cool. I didn't know you were into this. And I was like, yeah, it's kind of my real self.
You're like, it is?
Yeah.
It is cool.
I know. And so I think like what I'm realizing or what it led me to realize is like how much science needs humor and a lot of times how much comedy needs substance, you know? So I think I didn't realize that there was a need for both in both. And it's let me, like, I make this podcast Ologies. I started making it, like, I started in September, but it was an idea that I wanted to do for literally 15 years. Like, I saw a list of ologies 15 years ago on the internet, and I just like got nauseous with excitement. I was just nauseated. I was like, this is so, there's an ology about clouds and clowns and bees and all kinds of stuff. And I was like, someone's got to do something on this. And then I sat on it forever because I was just afraid of messing it up. I was afraid of not doing it right. And I finally put it out as a podcast. And it's like, that to me has been really great because, you know, that is not all ages. Some people listen with their kids, but I swear and I talk about, you know, adult things in it. And
can I cuss on my show?
Yes, you can cuss all you want.
I was going to say chodes. I just wanted to say chode. That's all.
We weren't talking about
chodes. You just named me a cuss word. It's just biology.
That's a design term.
Yeah, that's a design flaw.
Yes, it is.
Nature's design flaw.
It really is.
Rethinking
that
three-inch area is useless.
this last episode was evolutionary biology, so there's who knows. Oh, there might be something about it. But
I vote for removing the choke.
Yes.
Can you vote on like evolution?
I think it'll phase itself out. Yeah. Work itself out of the. But I think like doing ologies has been such a weirdly affirming thing where I'm like, okay, I can really be myself. I can say anything I want. And to have an audience and to have the audience build and not, I was so afraid I was going to put it out and like 1,000 people were going to listen and then be like, yeah, no, and like go away.
Yeah.
But it's been really cool to see it build and see that there's been a need for that, I guess. It's just someone to talk about science in a way that's like the dirty stuff and not like, you know, super, super sick, but just like the weird, gross stuff and the foibles in labs and people changing majors and stuff. So
as a science studier, did you ever do science?
Mm-hmm.
How deep does your science how deep do your science roots go?
My science roots, how appropriate is it for me to wear a lab coat without it being like stolen valor?
Exactly.
I got a microscope when I was like 7 or 8 and just was like kind of an offhanded, like I think what happened was my dad was probably in charge of Christmas presents that year, like last minute, and he probably just was like, sure, throw this in the basket. And I think they were expecting a boy when they had me, which was great because it fostered this interest in science in me.
Are you an only child?
No, okay. I'm the third daughter. So I grew up being
they were like, let's give him some Hot Wheels. And then it was like, oh, well, let's take those back.
I grew up going to like car shows and like I have so many power tools. And so I grew up kind of with, you know, I think that's part of what I love doing is being like a female voice for science, just because I think a lot of times it's women are neglected in that. Like, well, you know, all the shirts at Target are like science shirts for boys. And then the girls are like, I'm a baby princess. And so we're still taught that like it's not a woman's place. And I think so part of what I try to do, especially with ologies and with innovation, is, you know, I interview a ton of female innovators and CEOs and it's always great to show that kind of to show people who you wouldn't think of as a scientist, like are scientists. We haven't maybe grown up with them in the, you know, in pop culture. And, you know, even lately I pitch stuff to big science networks and I'm told we would love this if you were a guy. I'm still told that in 2018.
Really?
Mm-hmm. I got told last week that we love you. We love your voice. We love the show. You know, our audience is mostly male skewing and they don't want to hear science from a woman. Like, I'm still told that. And I'm like, oh, we have a ways to go here.
Well, admittedly, sometimes I'm probably just going to dig myself into a hole here. But, you know, sometimes when you're watching sports and you have the female commentary, it still feels awkward to me. Not that I don't want to see it, but I know that it's a, you know, slow shift. And so there's this like tide of change, but it takes a while.
It takes a while before you're used to seeing someone you're not. You know, you're used to seeing like an old dude in a bad sports coat with a headset being like, and he's on the outside. And then you're like, oh, what's this like semi-attractive person who looks like she's been outdoors?
Right.
And also, you know, I think that there's a weird
she looks like she's been outdoors.
You know what I mean?
Just outside.
Just outdoors. As opposed to like some like
smells like crispy leaves.
Which is someone who's like some anemic sports commentator who's like hasn't had his cholesterol checked in forever. But I think that's funny because it's like in that merging of having like women voices, you know, talking about things that are typically like seen as like male arenas, no pun intended. It's like, well, maybe if we just sexualize them, people will get used to them. So it's like, you know, you see like female meteorologists in like tiny cocktail dresses and like female sports commentators who have like have to get like eyebrow lifts before they're allowed on TV. So it's like, you know, it's still that extra price, but it's crazy because I personally know so many female scientists.
Right.
And I'm like, oh, this isn't represented. I know like so many neuroscientists, engineers at NASA, and they're just kind of too busy doing their work to really be like, oh, well, I guess on top of that, I've got to be an advocate for, you know, and they do it and they do it beautifully. But
well, that's what I was going to ask you, too. Like, how much of your advocacy shows up? Like, I don't see you at the soapbox, you know, leading the Nasty Woman March.
Right.
But it is like, look, I have a platform. I can just, you know, tell these stories on par with the rest of the other stories I tell.
Right. I think that's kind of what I try to do with ologies is I have about half women, maybe even a little bit more, is the ologists on, and I never brand it as like a women in STEM podcast because it's not. There's men too,
right?
And so I try to really diversify in all aspects who I talk to, and because I want people to get used to hearing, here's a scientist. Oh, it's a woman's voice. Or here's a scientist. Oh, they have an accent. Interesting.
Is that a woman?
Yeah. Like,
turn us off.
What's she doing in there?
No, it's a topic of conversation often, or especially now, right? There's a whole climate around like just divisiveness, or like I want my voice heard, and so on and so forth. And I've always felt like, you know, if you're going to do a women's panel, in some ways, it kind of does women a disservice. Because what happens is you gave them their 30 minutes, yep. And then you're like, all right, back to our normally scheduled, you know, programming.
You've invited them to the party and then put them at their own table. It right. feels like being in the kids' table sometimes. And you're like, I appreciate that at least it's that, you know, there's trying to be more visibility. But I just think when it comes to, genders and even like non-binary genders and diversity, like just incorporate everyone so that we get used
to it. Yeah, like a panel just look like what that particular industry looks like. So that's interesting. And I guess from a chatting with everybody that you've talked to on your show, mm-hmm. what is sort of, I guess, one of the biggest takeaways you've seen in creating analogy, or like what's your definition of analogy? And then what have you seen as like some of the common threads?
Oh, you know, it's funny because like I came across this list, right? And I also studied Latin. So when I was in high school.
What?
I know.
You came here telling me I was busy.
I mean, this is in high school, so I can't rest. I'm resting way back on those laurels. But sure. I always loved etymology. I always loved word origins. I think it's so interesting how elastic language and expression are. Like the way that we talk is culturally going to be so different in the future. So I always thought that was interesting. But so an ologist is anyone who studies, even if they're not professionally doing that, they're still a student of it. You're still a studier. You're still an ologist. If you're in, grad school, med school for endocrinology, like you're still an endocrinologist. So anyone who studies something in particular, like you might be. It's funny too, because the etymology of some of these gets so specific that you might be a toothologist who studies squids, but a toothologist is also a malacologist who studies mollusks. So it's like you can get pretty deep in there.
Yeah.
But so you are the only densinologist.
That's true.
Only one.
Yeah.
And so I think I
mean, there are other Densons, and I'm sure they study themselves to a degree. So
did you do an SEO? Did you like do a search engine optimization to make sure you were the only person with that tag and title?
So I was Densinator. and that was like an old AIM chat room name, when I used to get lucky. And but a couple of like my nephew ended up doing one on his own, and that, like a couple of other ones popped up, and I was let me see if I can change the game a little bit.
I love it.
So
I think it's I had a company called Curiology for a while that was my illustration and like a t-shirt company, and I think that's how I came upon the list of ologies. Is I was like, is curiology the study of curiosity? I wonder. And I looked it up, and it actually means writing with pictures. So if you have a symbol on a door that tells you that that's the exit, or a symbol on a door that says women's restroom, or whatever, that's curiological. That's a picture that is used to convey language. So I thought that was an interesting name. So that's how I came across the study of ologies.
It's actually fascinating. Like, every answer is like lead me to like 10 more questions.
I know.
It's like, well then what about? I'm just going to try to stump you. I think a lot of invention is reinvention to some degree. And I think it sounds like over the course of your career, you've done a bit of repositioning.
Oh God,
how do you get people to go along on the ride with you? Because, you know, I'm sure, I think one of the last times we talked, you did come on an old show I used to do and made us drinks. And it was super fun. But I think at the time you were already on, like, there was a new Allie Ward, right? So I reached out to you, like, make me some drinks, please. And you're like, okay, I'll do it. Like, you know, but I think sometimes when you are in this process of rebranding, even if you're a real brand, it's like, we've come to know you as X, but now you're Y. But it's on you as the person person who's changed to like tell that story. So how do you go about crafting your personal brand around your evolution?
Oh, it's so weird. It's funny because it's like, I felt like when I started doing science TV, I felt like people started seeing the real me. And I was really nervous about that because I felt like it was, you know, when I was doing Cooking Channel TV, and I still do to an extent, but like I would wear cocktail dresses. I was always with a friend of mine. Like we made crazy drinks that were kind of tongue in cheek and always had like kind of dark humor around it. So the sensibility and the humor and the writing were of a similar voice, but the topic was really different. And I think what started bumming me out was that I'll have a margarita every couple of weeks socially or whatever, but I'm not actually a big drinker. And what started to bum me out is that people started seeing me as like, they always were like, oh, were you drunk at the airport? And it was like, no, dude, like I'm hustling, like I'm working, like, right. You know, and I remember one of the first posts I did about the museum, I was like, I got my badge to start volunteering at the museum, you know.
And I'm drunk.
Yeah. Someone was like, uh-oh, you better not tip back too much whiskey before you teach kids stuff. And I was like, right. I'd done drunk history and stuff, but I just started to, it got to the point where I was like, okay, the brand that I have, I feel like is a little bit toxic to the world to just be like, I'm this girl that wears high heels and likes a good time. And I was just like, I studied so hard in school. I loved biology. I loved Latin. Like I always worked really hard to try to make like a good life for myself. And I just wound down this corridor that felt like a misrepresentation, like a super exaggeration of like that of happy hour, you know?
Right.
And so it became almost vital for me that like rebranding was like, I cannot die on earth having my greatest contribution be like a chicken McNugget cocktail. Like I have to be able to contribute more. Like, so it was almost like do or die. It was like, okay, well, I'm going to start posting the bugs I'm digging for on my off time. And I'm going to start, putting up pictures of friends who are like, you know, working on JPL spacecraft.
And right.
If people bail, then they bail. But at least I'll die having put out who I really was.
Again, it's like finding that entry point, which was like making cocktails and a dress. And like, and it was great entertainment, you know, and then not becoming that.
Yeah.
You know, or being cognizant of the fact that this is a character of sorts. Right. And which I think at the end of the day also just adds to your repertoire as an entertainer. You know, that you can embody a person who's different than who you are to an extent. But I think also from a journalistic standpoint, like you have to be you.
I think that there was something, you know, a few years ago, and I feel like it's especially in the last year or two, like, you know, social climate's so crazy and people's voices we're realizing that people keeping their voices silent has been super detrimental. People mm-hmm. thinking other people will speak for them has been detrimental. And so I think the last couple of years in particular, it's been like, oh, it's vital for everyone to be who they are. And it's vital for people to speak out against things that they don't think are cool. And it's vital for people to support other people who need it and to put a spotlight on people's work that's amazing that might not be getting attention. Like, that's all pretty vital. Like, it felt like, you know, the money I was making doing cocktail videos, like, dude, I wouldn't get paid a lot from the network, but the sponsorship deals you get are insane. And so there was a lot of pressure to keep that up because my persona is someone who's just like loves to drink a bottle of wine at 3 p.m. Like, that's lucrative. Like, wine companies are like, great. You know, like they are willing to pay.
Keep drinking.
Yeah. And so
we'll get you a new liver. Don't worry about it.
Exactly. Like, I'll pay for dialysis later when kidneys fail.
Good Groupon.
Exactly.
Yellowtails kidney dialysis Groupon. You and three of your friends.
Oh my God. So like, it was a lot of Merlot. Not good. So I was like, it just became like, okay, well, I had to make a choice. Like, I knew that that my work doing science and trying to fuse comedy and science had more longevity, because no one's going to want me as like a 50-year-old woman. It's super cute when your face still looks good. Right. But as soon as you start looking haggard, like you being like, you guys like whiskey? And it's like, sit down, Aunt Allie. Like,
hey, fellas.
Yeah, it's not cute anymore.
Well, people definitely don't want to see me as a 50-year-old woman. That's the other.
Well, I don't know. You've got great bone structure.
Thank you. Thank you. I just got it.
You just got it. Groupon. Once again, Groupon.
Yes. So you have a vast vocabulary. You've said a lot of words today.
Have I?
Yes.
Thank you.
Not like overly fancy, but they're like, I can see. And the reason I picked up on that, because you, at the very beginning, you mentioned vocabulary as a segment of what you do. Tell us about that. Tell us about the linguistics of Allie Ward when it comes to entertaining folks.
I just think linguistics are so fascinating. I think it's the weirdest thing. And I've always wanted to do like a book or an illustrated book about etymology. Like I remember I got this book of etymology years ago, back when people had books. And there was this one etymology, the word buxom. When you think of the word buxom, what do you think of?
Sorry, I was drinking some Kavita. They're not even a sponsor of the show.
Tipping it back.
Yes. I think of bosoms. That's exactly. The first thing I think of. Exactly. But it's usually the first thing I think of. So.
Well, it's always, what do you think of when I talk about jurisdiction?
Same thing.
Pelicans.
Yep. Yes,
All
roads lead
to bosoms. Okay, right.
Yes, but buxom, yes, that's the first thing that comes to mind.
So buxom has this etymology where it meant, it started meaning a pliable branch, a branch you could bend, and then it meant compliant, and then it meant cheerful, and then it meant sexy, and then it meant boobs. So like the etymology of the word buxom has just changed incrementally from a twig you can bend to like, what a great rack. And I remember being like, what is language? Like none of it is in concrete. It's changing all the time.
Right.
That's so weird. Like we're sitting at a desk, and a desk could be like, could mean like a nuptial. It could be like could end up being like something that's totally different depending on how it's used.
That's very true.
Do you know what I mean?
Yeah. How does that happen?
I think it's just incremental changes in context. And so I think that like, I think it's so interesting that our brains shape what we use to communicate as we need it. Like the words don't define us, we define the words. And so I always was really interested in etymology. And so, you know, we do this segment at the end of Innovation Nation where it's called Mocabulary, although some people have said it should be called Ward's Words or Allie-cabulary. But it's Mo. We love Mo. It's Mocabulary. But we take the two biggest words from the show, like our two most obscure words that you might not know, and then we define them at the end. So
that's cool.
And it started, it's really cool how it started because we shot our first episode and we were talking to someone who was a healthcare innovator, and they used the word democratize about healthcare. And the editors were like, shoot, we should take this out. That's going to be too big a word. And our showrunner, Jim Lichtenstein, was like, well, wait, what if we keep it in, but then we just add a segment where we define the words? So it was great. It really kind of encourages us to speak up to the audience instead of speak down to them.
Yeah.
And so, and then I get to look at etymology and define the words and make this crazy segment at the end. Yeah,
no, that's 1,000% fascinating.
Like, yeah, I think it's cool that they had a choice. Like there was a pivot in the road where they're like, let's dumb this down or let's make it even better. And I think it's so cool that they did that. And then it gives me an extra segment, you guys. Double the FaceTime.
I think about where the word dick came from.
Mm-hmm. Where did it come from?
I have no idea. It's like Richard as a nickname. And it was like, was Richard such a jerk or so sexually active? Like, was it what happened where this became like, not only is it a euphemism for an organ, it's also sure like is. An insult.
I know.
It's all the, it means like to tinker around. Like, I know. Oh, why are you dicking around over there? It's just like.
I'm going to look it up after this.
Yes.
I do this on ologies all the time. Like ologies always starts with the etymology of the ology. And like gynecology came from a Greek word gwen, which means queen. So gynecology is just like the study of your queen of sorts.
I know that's right.
So every single one is super, I think is kind of interesting. Like,
do you have a guiding principle or mantra that you operate by?
Just more money, more money, more money.
More money, more money, more money, more problems. No. Like great notorious B.I.G. statement.
I gave him that. He was like, can I use that? And I was like, Piggy, go for it.
You're like, that was a conversation at the Peterson Automotive Museum?
Yes, it was.
You're like, all right, I'll see you tomorrow.
I love the Peterson, dude.
Eric's here. I don't think you know, Biggie died right after he left the Peterson Automotive Museum. He was shot and killed. All right.
I was like, catch you later. Call me tomorrow. Not so much.
It's almost not fun. I have a couple did you answer the question before I go off on a tangent?
I can't remember. I think my guiding principle is just Probably, you know, actually, I had to go. I was moderating a panel at the Dolby Theater, which was like a million people. And I was very nervous. It was super, I was very nervous. And I was like, ah! Like I had the thing where I was like, I need a diaper, but I'm just going to do it. I'm just going to do this anyway. And the thing that I told myself right before I went on is show up like you belong and have fun. And ever since then, that was a couple years ago. And whenever I'm super nervous about something or I'm doubting myself, it's always just like, just show up like you belong and just try to roll with it. Like usually being like, maybe if I'm uptight, people will take me seriously. Yeah. Like, it doesn't really work. Just be yourself.
Well, I think that it's funny. I mean, it's a great principle, especially when I think about, you know, the audience of this show, you know, who are aspiring innovators. And most of us walk into a pitch of some sort. Either you're pitching yourself, like in the instance that you just described, mm-hmm. or you're pitching a business concept, or you're pitching something internally that you want. And we show up from a place of lack. Like, yes. I need to convince you that this is the thing. As opposed to... You know, like you just said, is showing up and owning it. Like you need this, not like I need to sell this to you.
It's, you know, how often do you come across this? And I just talked about this in the gynecology episode, oddly enough, is talked about imposter syndrome. Have you come across it? Have you?
All the time. Like I have imposter syndrome all the time. Like
it's crazy how common it is with super high achieving, super intelligent people. Have imposter syndrome, and it's almost a mark.
Well, thank you.
I mean, no, literally, I honestly studied this. Like, I am flattering you because I want a free copy of your book, but I'm also being honest. But no, like, it's funny. The opposite of it is called the Dunning-Kruger effect, where you don't realize how stupid you are. Like, the Dunning-Kruger effect is when you're like, for example, I'm the best, which we hear sometimes.
Right. I'm a social media guru.
Yeah. Like, no, or you hear it from political parties sometimes. Yes, but